This is James, the most acid I've ever seen anybody eat in my life. Wow, man!
Fire it up, Holmes!
Why don't you get a job, Spicoli?
What for?
You need money.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
Welcome and thanks for tuning in to Revolution Radio. And now it's time for that feral hippie herself, an infotartic, esoteric, eclectic mix of the adventures of that feral hippie, Miss Mona Radler.
What are you people? On dope?
That was my skull! I'm so wasted!
Make a move and the funny gets it.
Dave's not here!
All right, Mona, it's all yours. Take it away.
Welcome, welcome, one and all, to the 14th day of September 2020, here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio. Don't forget, we are listener supported. That's right. So please help us out, hook us up, give us some of that funny money. And help us stay on air, won't you please, won't you please, won't you please. It's about the only way we're going to get any of this information out there. Yeah, good old Joe Rogan wants to have a 4-hour debate with Trump and Biden. I don't know what they've done. Where, what the hey are they really thinking? What are they really thinking? How the heck are they gonna do that? Now, hopefully you can hear me because my clock has stopped. Yep, is it gonna start up again? Okay, come on, you can do it, you can do it. Come on, clock, start again. Boy, is everybody else having electronic issues? Stuff on my page is missing. My bottom bar, where the heck did my Avast go? I mean, all kinds of strange things. It took me I had to go through a back door just to get into Facebook. Now that is peculiar. Oh, where did it go? It doesn't like to give me this little, the little Skype thing anymore. It's like it just takes it away. Oh, but we're in the not responding mode. Oh, gosh. Just one of those things of one of those days because it's Monday. And it doesn't want to play fair. No, it don't. It don't want to play fair. So, yeah, just crazy. Yep, crazy. So, let's see if this works out. And it keeps coming up, no response. Yeah, well, please, just wait until later. Come on, not responding. Bar, my little box. Telling me that I am still hooked up, supposedly. That's right. It is, supposedly. I was here, I swear, I was here. But that little blue ring keeps going round and round and round. Is everybody else extra tired lately? I mean, I shouldn't be extra tired. No. All right, this is going to be a little long, but hey, you know, it's just the way it goes. And I just think it's something that's got shared with me, and I figured I'd better share it with y'all. So, let us hear what is happening now on that September 8th, 2020, when it was put out there.
Hello, all. I've been asked by many people for an update to the last summary I did of the data and science and facts around our viral issue. It's been a few weeks, so here is the crucial update. I'm going to start with the curves for deaths per million for many European countries, Italy, UK, Ireland, Sweden. And as you can see, they're all very similar in shape. And the epidemic largely ended around May, early June, and now we're down to very low levels. And this is entirely in line with influenza epidemics in the past. So I'm going to show that Europe, the average here, is similar shape, of course. And there were some countries with lesser impacts, and we're going to show you why shortly. So there's Europe. The important thing to note is that, as per Professor Michael Levitt, in the northern temperate regions like Europe or North America, Northeast, you get a Gompertz curve. And the reason is because the virus, when it comes in new, it rapidly hits around 20% of the population. So around 80%, it's becoming clear, are already de facto immune through cross immunity, T cell, mucosal immunity from prior coronavirus in the large family of coronaviruses. It's got huge similarity, this SARS-CoV-2, to prior coronaviruses. So our immune system has many mechanisms to react. But around 1 in 5 people or 20% will be less cross-immune, and they're the ones that it has to go through. But in any case, as it goes through those people, you get the sad passing of the susceptible, and you get the majority of the people who are susceptible to infection become infected, and then the virus has much more difficulty and stumbles over immune people all over the place. So you get the turning of the curve, and this is entirely normal, and then it comes down in the Gompertz fashion. So just to show for influenza, here's a publication in the last 10 years about the Spanish flu, and you see the classic Gompertz curve as well. So this is entirely kind of normal, if you will, for a new virus that comes along. Now, we're going to look at all-cause deaths, excess deaths in respiratory seasons over the last couple of years. And this is from Euromomo. It's very important to look at excess death because the measure of cases or infections depends on how much testing you're doing and how good the test is, and it's really noisy. So death is the best measurement. Euromoma has 360 million people in the countries it tracks. And we're going to look at 2018 excess death. And as you can see, it's here, and you can integrate or add up all of the weeks of death and get the totals. So we did that, and approximately 140,000 excess deaths in the over 45 years of age bracket, which is the one of interest. So 140,000. It seems like a lot, but remember that's out of 360 million people. So it's actually a very small fraction. When we move on towards 2020, we note first that 2019 had a very soft flu season right up to early 2020. So we really had a lot of people built up here who would otherwise sadly have passed. So when COVID seasonally struck, there was a lot of dry tinder, is one term that's being used. All those aged, susceptible, comorbid who are around to sadly be hit with the coronavirus. And the total, if you add it all up in this curve, is around 180,000 people. So you'll note that it's not much different than 2018, and we really didn't do anything in 2018, although some hospitals were overflowing in UK, for instance. But generally speaking, the difference is not great. Now, some people may comment that, oh yes, but we did lockdowns and masks and things this year. But they have been shown to have very little impact in analyses. So we're going to look at that. So this is a fair compare. And actually, the impact of 180,000 is lower than the year 2000 for excess death in the season. So the main difference is that Corona, the season was very short and sharp because of the soft prior season and other factors. It dramatically occurred in 6 weeks, these excess deaths, rather than around 4 or 5 months. So that's one big difference. So explaining this, why were the deaths not much different than 18? Well, one reason is that the modelling was catastrophically high in its estimations. So here's one report that shows what was modelled by Imperial College and others for Sweden with no lockdown and with hard lockdown. And as you can see, the actual death impact is down here in the blue, and it's around 10 or 15 times lower than the modelling. And remember, Sweden had no lockdown, no masks, and even had hairdressers, bars open, little bit of distancing, but they allowed crowds up to 50 as well. So clearly the modelling was catastrophically high, and that's one explanation. Another study here pulled out by CoronaPogue on Twitter, and you can see here for different amounts of lockdown, from no lockdown down to super hard lockdown, there's huge numbers predicted for Sweden, but the actual was less than 6,000. So again, the modelling out by a factor of 15 plus, and that's what threw the world into turmoil. So here's another view of Sweden from Johan Hellström, done some great analysis. And as you can see, they had their epidemic, which waned, and now all during August, tiny amounts of ICU and mortality. And they had 16-year-olds up to 16 going to school all during the epidemic, no masks, and very mild distancing and some other measures. But they just went through this classic Gompertz curve regardless. Opening up in the summer, nothing's happening. Pretty much community immunity established to an effective level. And that's pretty much how it's always been with these epidemics. So that's Sweden. Just to show you another cut in Sweden, because it's topical, Johan, I think, pulled this out as well. And out of the nearly 6,000 mortality in total, only 870 were directly caused by COVID with no other comorbidities. And obviously the average age was way up in the 70s too, and mostly care homes. But this red curve is the most direct no comorbidity curve for mortality. And it's clearly massively smaller than the curve that you see given around to the world. Sweden, another perspective from Johan, and this one is really interesting. He's pulled out all the data from the Swedish records, monthly death rates, and it's deaths per million. So it's corrected for population size, because clearly over 150 years, the population changed a lot. So let's look and see, what's this spike here? Looks pretty huge. Well, that's the Spanish flu spike, and it is actually quite huge. It was a once in a century or maybe a few centuries event. But if we look down on the right, we're wondering, well, where is Corona? Because we have the data now and the spike is over for Corona or SARS-CoV-2. And actually, here's the Corona spike. So that should put things in perspective. It's not much different, like for all of Europe, actually, I showed you earlier, not much different than certain months in the previous 10 or 20 years. So that's really what's actually happened in excess mortality. PLC pulled out some great data. Everyone should know about this. And it speaks to why Sweden would have been higher than other countries, particularly the Nordics. So we can look up mortality.org, but here's the graphs. So we see the Netherlands had a particularly soft prior season with a kind of a trough of less than expected or fewer than expected deaths, 19 through to early 20. And Netherlands got hit quite hard then with SARS-CoV-2 or COVID, understandably, because a lot of people had built up who would have been very frail and otherwise probably would have passed away before. We see the same for Great Britain, a huge trough here and then a nasty spike when Corona came. And we see the same for Spain, pretty much. So this pattern is repeated throughout nearly all the countries. But let's look at Sweden. We see that Sweden certainly had a large trough. In fact, I think nearly 4,000 less than would usually occur. And interestingly, that's most of their spike when COVID came along. Okay, so let's keep Sweden here and now look at the Nordics that we have data for. I wonder, do they look different, right? Independent of lockdown. And sure enough, very different looking graph. They had normal enough death rates in the prior years. And again, they had a low spike for COVID. COVID. And Norway, similar to Finland, very different than Sweden. So this is most likely the biggest factor driving Sweden's numbers and most countries' numbers, actually, independent of lockdown and distancing. I have a gap here and I don't have Denmark, so I'll just drop in Hungary. You can see they had actually quite a above average mortality the last couple of years and almost no impact from COVID, which goes in line with that. There's other analyses done, like David Spiegelhalter here, an analysis of severity of prior flu season versus how hard COVID hit in deaths per 100,000. And as you can see, countries that had more severe prior seasons had very low COVID impact. And conversely, countries that had soft prior seasons tended to have high COVID impact, as you would expect. And finally, a publication just out, 16 possible factors for Sweden's high COVID death rate among the Nordics. And the lockdown differences are kind of number 16. And this team from the analysis say they're the least part of it. Their number one is the dry tinder situation in Sweden, as we just discussed. And they reckon it could account for up to 50% of their total death toll. I'd guess it's quite a bit higher than that. But they have another 14 reasons. Lockdown is in the halfpenny place, as we say in Ireland. Okay. Carol Hennigan, a professor of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, asked a great question quite a while ago. There's 50,000 pubs almost in the UK, and let's say 1,000 a week through the door. They've been open for a long time with no masks, right, and token distancing. That's nearly 300 million people interactions in 6 weeks. Now, it's nearly half a billion now because it's 3 weeks later than this tweet. So how many outbreaks occurred with nearly half a billion people in pubs with no masks moving around indoors? Well, let's take a look at the UK's actual mortality impact. Here's where we're talking about where the pubs are open with no masks, basic distancing. So let's see what happened. 2 months or more, actually, 9.5 weeks since this began. Interesting. So not only is there no spike whatsoever, but quite the opposite, that during 10 weeks of this reality, right, it just kept falling. And that's because these curves are baked in, essentially, as we've discussed earlier.
Now he's talking September 7th, so summer is supposed to have kept everything down because sunshine and fresh air kills a lot of germs and diseases. So I guess it means some people are getting back outside in that, but this is the curve. It's like crazy that we're still going through this wearing the mask and all this other crap. It's just BS. Too much still BS.
Immunity, the passing of the susceptible, the seasonal changes in the virome and other factors dictate this curve. And we humans trying to do fancy things that were never tried in history, often that just doesn't work or do anything. So there you are. So any pub owners in Ireland watching this or the Vintners Association should be asking the question, why the hell have we had pubs closed in Ireland for the past few months? And it would be a very good question, and I think we've answered it here. Bazuo Greengrove, I've probably butchered that, did a nice analysis. It's very busy, but I'll just go through the basics. He painstakingly pulled out the USA seasonal impact of prior flus, like 57 and 68, 69 and 59. And he also did a 1942 one, which was huge impact. But the notable thing here is they all have the double hump shape, which I'm going to describe to you shortly. And COVID is here, and it's no different really than these prior ones. Lesser impact, actually. But we never did any lockdowns and things before. We did it for COVID. But another thing he pulled out is that, interestingly, these red lines show the influenza and respiratory disease patterns across the full year from week 1 to week 52 in the USA in prior years. But he pulled out the influenza for this year, 2020. Now, this year had masses of lockdowns and masks all over the place, and that was a real unique difference with prior years. But notice in the tan space here, they got the exact same influenza and respiratory deaths as normal. So influenza and respiratory deaths completely ignored the lockdowns and the masks, which again is the point where we're trying to make. This is another view of it. This hump here in 2020 was the corona impact being inappropriately put into influenza and pneumonia at the start. But then they fixed that. And as you...
Oh, where are you going?
You can see 2020 influenza and pneumonia, no impact from lockdowns, didn't change the curve. And finally, I won't read this out, but I did this back in late April, early May, explaining all of the evidence against lockdown being effective. Many professors, universities have published now, and I'll just pull out a couple of interesting ones that are logical. The millions of grocery workers across Europe and the US, right through the epidemic, never mind now, had no mask indoors, 8 hours a day. They were non-lockdown. The great unwashed people coming in and out all day long. They showed no signal for extra infection or mortality. The essential workers, same thing, no signal. And many, many countries have dropped the lockdown since even late April, early May, all the way through all across Europe, and the curves.
But we are. We're still being...
Never stopped going down. Yeah. They never changed shape. The lockdown effectively had no impact, even though the belief system is that it should. Sorry, guys. Science is tough that way. And last thing, there's a link here I'll put in the bottom of this video or in the first comment, and it's just a Dropbox where there's around 5 published papers on lockdown analysis explaining what I just said and a few articles, though we're seeing many more, even in the Wall Street Journal now, slowly, reluctantly acknowledging that lockdown was a massive mistake and will cause far more death than it ever saved. Masks, I'll mention briefly. I know it's a hot topic, but I go with the science. Here's a paper looking at 14 randomized control trials of masks and surgical masks in preventing influenza viral transmission, and no support for a substantial effect. Basically, all these randomized trials over many years. So the science of the last 40 years was unanimous, and the WHO right up until late 2019. No way were they worth using. They might even backfire. And it all changed in June 2020, and suddenly people somewhere, influential people, wanted everyone in masks. So, but I'd go with 40 years of science rather than a few weeks of questionable science in quotes. So that's just the reality with masks. Just to illustrate it empirically, here's Germany. Mandatory masks came in. Curve never changed. Kept falling. Austria, mandatory mask came in. Curve didn't change. Maybe it went up a bit. Poland, mandatory mask came in. Curve didn't change, the R curve. And we see this all over Europe. There is no measurable impact between mandatory mask orders whenever they come in and any impact on outcomes. Okay, so that's just the way it is. So sorry about that, but the mandatory and prison sentences and arguments with police and, you know, fines all around masks are very, very non-evidence-based, bad science, and the empirical data reflects that. So, sorry, guys. Now, I'm going to just remind you now about 140,000 excess deaths in 18 across Europe, nearly 400 million people in the respiratory season, and 180 for this year. And we've just gone through why lockdown and other measures didn't really change anything. So this comparison is what it is. And it may surprise many people that this is it. Maybe it's around 30% higher this year than 18. And other years in the last 20 were higher again. And no panic occurred and no damage to our society. So there you are. Seasonality, very important. So I'm going to go through it with updated figures. Coronaviruses are sharply seasonal, super seasonal, like influenza. You know, this has been known for a long, long time. It's being denied in the past few months for some reason, but it's been known. So I'm going to show you here Italy, deaths per million. March, April, it rose up and down. And they tried, it happened. But look at Brazil and Peru, a longer, steadier rise. And interestingly, Brazil had no lockdown. President was getting abused for that decision. And Peru had a hard lockdown, military style, with mandatory masks and everything back here in March. Okay, and hard lockdown. But look, right? Peru, if anything, is worse. You know? So this is just re-stressing the point about lockdown. However, there's something else interesting. I've left space here to the left. What about November 2019? Why am I interested in showing that? Well, because it's crucial. Because in 2019, November, SARS-CoV-2 has been verified in human sewage samples, just like it has been for Spain and elsewhere in Europe. So this virus, SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID in some people, was circulating in the population in Brazil, back here, same as Europe. But look at the difference of the virome triggering, right? Totally different behavior. So the virome is complex, and it rises based on UV and humidity and human immune, you know, seasonal variations, you know, many things. And it just ignores the human medieval science interventions that we've done this year. Transmission of epidemic influenza. I'm going to put a link below. Highly recommend you read the PDF. Edgar Hope Simpson, a doctor who spent 50 years...
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio, at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
The little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away. All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
So basically, so far, what we're finding out is we've been played. We've been played by a bunch of military actions trying to control us and put us in some kind of fear mode, which doesn't make sense to me. Who am I? I'm just a feral hippie. So let's see if he's got anything more to say. Maybe. Maybe he will, maybe he won't.
Here, dramatically different than Brazil with no lockdown, Peru with a lockdown. But the big difference is these southern tropical regions, completely different triggering than the northern temperate. So we're going to bring in a couple of excerpts from Hope Simpson's graphs, and we're going to see here that for northern temperate, which is Italy and northern Europe, we've got a pattern. And we've got a pattern called out in his book for southern tropical. And if we match up those patterns approximately, we see a rather excellent match, which is exactly what you'd expect. So like I said, super seasonal. I wouldn't worry about where on the axis they occur in terms of exact month. It's more around the seasonal relative differences and regional differences, independent of lockdowns. Europe versus USA. So a lot of people asking about USA, and it is tough over there because while Europe has long finished with the epidemic, USA got a second kind of surge, and a lot of people are misunderstanding this. They think it's a second wave. It's not a second wave. So USA, if it was only Northeast USA you were looking at, which is seasonally, regionally like Europe, you see this in the data. It behaves just like Europe, and it's falling off or fallen off to nothing. However, this part of the curve is southern USA, and that's what's driving the extended hump. And this is the classic double hump we've seen for all prior influenza epidemics. This is actually normal, even though all deaths are sad. It is fading, coming down now, which is good news. So a little more detail. I pulled the data from the US database, and I'm going to use the same scale here of deaths per million, up to 70. And here's Northeast. New York got hit really hard, of course. But the Northeast US, you've got the Gompertz type curve like Northern Europe. And that's because it's Northern Temperate type pattern, Europe-like. When we look at the South, it's very different. Not only is it surging out here, right, in a different time frame, but overall the impact in deaths per million daily is massively lower than the Northeast, you know, because these are the same scale. So this is northern tropical type pattern, and it's more like Mexico and desert regions. Midwest is actually more like northern temperate type pattern, Europe-like or like Northeast America. And for comparison, you can see here spikes in March, April comes right down. Obviously, there's lower impacts overall, but the shape is similar. And then we have USA West is more like the USA South, it's northern tropical type pattern, and you can see here rising in the last few months and then thankfully coming back down now. And again, very low impacts compared to Northeast. So hopefully that helps people understand USA patterns. Now the case demic I'm going to kind of roll to a close with. There's hysteria the last few months over the summer, even though I clearly showed in Europe that the epidemic was over since May. And the reason is because we're hyper-testing with PCR. So I'll explain that. So here you have the curves I showed earlier in, for Europe, and you see the epidemics come down. This was an epidemic, in fairness, and this is not an epidemic. Epidemic's over as we get out to June, July. However, if you kept testing with PCR and, in fact, increased your testing, you would find viral fragments, dead virus, people who recovered months ago who were asymptomatic. You'll find some positive cases, but there'll be very little impact. You'll have a case-demic. And that's the problem we're seeing in Europe over the past couple of months with stringent measures, draconian measures based on PCR testing. So this is a great post for you to get an idea of the problems with PCR testing. Just Google this term here. There's the link. Professor Carl Hennigan again goes through the challenges. If you hypertest with PCR tests, they find viral dead fragments. They don't find full live virus. They can't identify that. They're calling them cases when they get a PCR positive. They are not, mostly. A case is hospitalization with severe impacts or COVID-19, the disease. These are simply positive tests from a viral fragment test kit. They are not cases. So a lot of confusion. This is what causes a case-demic. So to show a few countries, Ireland, we had an epidemic, rising cases and fall, and we had deaths follow it, sadly. Older, comorbid, average age 82, median age 84. So, yes, we had an impact. Epidemic ends, but now we test. We're getting PCR false positives, historical infections, some true positives, but the impacts are on the floor. So for Ireland in August, we had 700 cancer deaths, we had 33 suicides, we had effectively zero COVID deaths on the record. So, but all people are talking about is COVID. They don't care about the suicides, the cancers, the economic catastrophe. People don't seem to care about anything, even though they don't realize the epidemic's gone. UK, briefly, I'll just show it's the same problem. Enormous cases, local lockdowns, nothing's really happening. Now, as we come into fall and winter, we will see a natural rise in the virome. We'll see influenza. We'll see more impacts in hospitals. We'll see SARS-CoV-2 rising again. But that will be more normal winter resurgent of influenza like prior years, I would say. Germany, same story. I won't read it out. Switzerland, exact same story. They brought in mandatory masks in these countries back here when the epidemic was already over. That doesn't affect anything. Spain is being called out as having a second wave in the making. And sure, the deaths are rising a little. But as we'll see, that's not unusual in Spain as they head into fall and winter. So there's pockets here and there. But there's only around one death per million people per day in Spain at the moment. And that's being seen as a surge. So it's vastly lower than when the real epidemic occurred. But this will probably grow. But that doesn't mean it's a second wave by any means. But you can see the enormous amount of cases here, right? Absurd. And then these very small impacts. And then we've got Netherlands, same story. And we've got France, same story. Talk of a second wave in France now, just because hospitalizations have gone up a bit coming into the fall. But again, similar summary. And US, I'll acknowledge, as I already have, that because of the southern and western regions, they're virome triggered. So they genuinely do have, with extra cases, a rise in mortality. But thankfully, that's falling down now, too. So have we seen this before, like the case-demic phenomenon? And this is important. This is from a government document. And it shows the H1N1 swine flu, where there were actual impacts in 2009 in the winter, and people died, not nearly as many as were modelled. But a fascinating thing happened then. They brought out a rapid PCR test called FluChip, and they started testing like crazy. And all during that summer, when the deaths were gone from swine flu, there was a freak out with huge tests and all the media going crazy. But no one was dying. So that was a case-demic. And they kept pushing it even into the fall, right? But H1N1, there were no real deaths. It had passed in its first season, as mostly they do. But there was a case-demic going on and a lot of hysteria until eventually they gave up on it. Now, the interesting thing is there were no lockdowns or masks back here during this safe summer And that may have helped the following winter season be very soft, because you had a lot of community immunity develop over the summer, but without much death impact. So that point we're going to bring up at the end again in the context of Spain and see what it might mean. Last one on this, it just shows the UK, and here's the seasonal increases in mortality, perfectly normal with influenzas, and down here we have the testing. But in 2010, in the summer, they were testing like crazy because of the swine flu panic. So you see an enormous spike in cases, but actually the lowest death that summer of the past 20 years. So it shows you the danger of a casedemic. This article, very important to read to understand why casedemics happen and the driving forces behind them. So it's a German mainstream Spiegel newspaper back in 2010 did this article. It's comprehensive, and it really is a great article and explains a lot of what goes on when these things occur. So I recommend that. Now, another thing in terms of second waves in Europe and Spain and anywhere, it's important to note that, you know, influenza are shown in the three curves here, and they do fall in the summer. And then as you get into the fall, and this is only August, you see that you start seeing more influenza. So this is normal. And the blue bars are coronavirus cases in 2020, and they're following a similar pattern. Yeah, so there's nothing too abnormal about this, and that's probably important to internalize. Okay, so that's just a point to note. The Spanish second wave I'll finish on, because everyone's fear-mongering about second waves, and nothing is impossible in science, in fairness. So here we show Spain again, and we show the huge up to 800-900 deaths per day at the peak of the actual epidemic. And then, as I described, community immunity, passing of the susceptible, seasonal vectors, it fell right down to nothing. So in May, it was effectively gone. I think these deaths were added in from a prior period. So recently, there's been talk of hospitalizations, and indeed, there's mortality. Now, this is with COVID as opposed to necessarily from COVID. So I got to be careful here. But there is a rise, and people are talking about second waves. But what I would suggest is a second wave, a true one, would look something like this. Now, it would rise up and come back down again and be very impactful. But this kind of coming into fall increase is nothing like that so far. And I want to remind people of Euromomo, which is the mortality excess for all countries in Europe. And here's Spain. And you can see in 17, there's the big hump in excess mortality. And in 18, 19 was softer, right? And there's COVID, 2020. But let's look at 17 and bring it down here. And what would it be like if 2020 going into 21 was even like 17? So let's bring it down here and extend out the months out to March and scale it approximately. Well, Spain could easily be heading into this in terms of mortality. Right? And but this would be actually normal. And in here, you're going to have influenzas found. You're going to have SARS-CoV-2 found. If SARS-CoV-2 dominates, then it may kick out the influenza deaths and they'll attribute more to COVID-2 and to COVID. But either way, this is coming anyway. And so, you know, we've got to be careful that this is not attributed to some kind of second wave if it does look just like pretty much like 17. But we'll see what happens, and we'll be watching the authorities on how they're reporting it. Now, there is one difference this year, however. Even though lockdowns and stuff don't really work, they could have an effect that's negative. They're going to cause way more cancer deaths from late diagnoses, way more, you know, malnourishment and suicide and dreadful suffering and impacts due to destroying economies. And they're taking away our cherished freedoms and causing terrible societal impacts. So the lockdowns and all that are causing huge damage, and that's being acknowledged in mainstream media. But here's another potential damage. For the first time in history, based on poor science, we've been putting in draconian measures all summer. And that's the safe period where the virus can circulate with very low mortality, and you can build T cell and build mucosal and build population community immunity. And that's going to tend to protect the old and the frail next winter. But we've kind of gone in and tried to stop it for the first time in history, right? So what could happen here, it's reasonable to hypothesize, is the winter could be relatively worse than it needs to be in terms of death and injury of the susceptible and the weak, the very ones we want to protect. So wouldn't it be ironic if actually what would have been a mid-range winter actually became worse because we had not developed the normal ancestral evolutionary summer period community immunity?
Yeah.
Now that would be an enormous backfire. And it probably shows the potential dangers of doing things that are not scientifically based, like Sweden did it, doing things that are not based on good science and continuing them all summer, could have pretty terrible unforeseen consequences, in which case the people pushing this would tend to have blood on their hands next winter. So unintended consequences occur all the time, but they most frequently occur when you don't follow the science, the best science. That makes unintended consequences, damage, injury and death, the most likely, is when you don't follow good science. And to be quite frank, going into the winter now of 2020 and into the January of 2021 in Europe, this is actually what I'd have a concern with, that we squandered a summer where we could have had the normal evolutionary relatively safe spread of this virus when people had high immune function and just after the susceptible had already passed, right? A safe spread, if you will, right? And that may put the vulnerable at greater risk next winter, which, as I say, would be ironic and tragic. And you can add that to all the extra effects of lockdown, etc., and all the other problems which have been acknowledged all over the world now, in the media even. So I leave it at that, but I think it's a sobering thought, and I'm going to be watching like a hawk in the coming months for exactly what the winter arises and patterns are, and using our worldwide network of solid scientists to tie these things together and make sure that a truthful, fair narrative comes out from whatever we face in the coming months. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'll do another update shortly. Thank you. Thanks for listening, guys. And just a reminder that I do need support to continue putting together all of this content.
Yes.
And at patreon.com/
Ivor Cummins. C-U-M-I-N-S if you feel like
support. Ivor Cummins.
Patreon and...
Or for PayPal at tinyurl.com/ Ivor Cummins, where you can
don't
do a one-off or a monthly.
First, put Revolution Radio on your donation pile. That's right. Yes, I have a donation pile.
So
Revolution Radio is the first one. Yep, the top one to get it. That's right.
Hi, I'm Dr. Paul Mason, and today I'm going to...
Yeah, but Dr. Paul, I don't really care. I'm talking dementia and diet. But just in case, I will put it back. Or copy it and put it in chat.
Putting together all of this content, yeah. And at patreon.com/...
There we go. All right. Yeah, because we really have no clue what the heck is actually going to be happening or coming down. Because they're taking so much of our life away from us. I mean, oh my gosh. Just too much of our life away from us. Yes. And they're just making up a bunch of stuff, too. I really believe that. I believe that they're making up a whole bunch of stuff just because they can. And they want us to live in fear. They want us to stay in fear. They don't want us to have a common sense and use our critical thinking to get through these things. I mean, they just don't want it. Nope. And I've tried to get into the chat, and it's just having a heck of a time with me to get into the chat. Because otherwise I would post other things that I'm doing, but I'm not going to be playing or doing. Yeah. So why are we allowing just all this to keep going? It's like, did I do my shopping yesterday? No, I did. Okay, it's Saturday. And I went around and I didn't put a face mask on. Nobody said anything to me or nothing else because it was like, hey, I can't live a lie. I can't believe you people are all living a lie. And it just doesn't make sense to live a lie. I mean, jeez. What sense does that make? Aren't we here to find out truths? Aren't we here to make it better for everything on this planet? But, oh my gosh. All we need is reality to take place. Yeah, like poor Oregon. Oh gosh, they're in deep trouble. And I heard this video earlier. I think I was going to try and go get it, but it was like the computer is playing its own, you know, how it plays with us. Yeah. Like even though I'm clicking, doesn't mean it's doing anything. Nope, like frozen, man. Frozen. Well, I guess that means I could take it down and come back up, huh? Yeah. Yeah, I want everybody to have rain too, and they're just not allowing it. They're just not allowing it. They're sending it all through Canada. Yep. So, it does seem like we're just having some time of it all, really. But, yeah, we're probably going to have rain here, and it just got done raining yesterday. And, just so much that's going on that basically we need to really stand up and figure out who we are and what the heck we're doing with it and what we're going to do with it. Seriously. Yep. Yep, it's just, oh my gosh. Yeah, I'd love to. Oh, I do. Get your rain sticks out, right? Yep, send the West Coast some wetness. My gosh. I didn't mean to do all that. It did it itself. I'm telling you, I'm just having some strange computer time. Goodness gracious, six love. Yep, we need it. Yeah, what was it? Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, I'll see if I can find it. But let's see. There's something I want to play. Do I have 4 minutes? Let's see. Yeah, it brought tears to my eyes. It was just really something else. Yeah, if they'd let me play it. I'm going to bring it back to the beginning. I don't know. Come on, bring it back to the beginning. Yep. I just can't make it work. Come on, computer. Why don't you want it the way I want it? Why can't you do it the way I want it? Ugh. I would have had enough time, but nope. We'll see. None of us have control of anything. All we can do is control how we handle it. I mean, big time. Yep, that's all we can do. Let's try to handle it the way that it can be done in our best interest altogether, seriously. In our best interest. Because that's all we're here to do, really. I can't change other people's minds. I'd love to give proof and information so you can change your own mind on what information and proof that I have found that made me believe it. Because I can't say that you should believe everything I believe either. No, I'm not about to go there. Heck no. That we just have to open our eyes a little wider. And I know we're all tired of it. We've all had enough. And we just want to be able to get back into how our lives are supposed to be. Not the way that lives... have been brought to where we are today. Yep. I had to take it down. Because if I don't, then it's going to come up. And I don't want it to come up and being played over the promo, so we'll get it back. Yeah. There's just too much that we really, really have to try to remedy one way or the other. We have the answers. We really, really do. But hey, that's just me thinking, you know.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The blood is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, the heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. 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 Radio! Radio.
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number 3 is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne. And I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in defense condition 1. As we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in, and I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for the unequivocal truth, DEFCON 1.
We shall never surrender.
Hello, all you good-looking people out there in Revolution Radio. This is Mario. I invite you to join me Thursdays at 6 o'clock for This, That, and the Other. It's a show about you. It's a show about me. but ultimately it's a show where we try to have a little bit of fun. We discuss important topics, and we do our best to be apolitical. So I invite you, put on your favorite pair of comfy sweats, your smoking jacket, and grab a beverage of your choice, and join me Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock for This, That, and the Other on Revolution Radio.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Location might be a few differences depending upon which browser you use. I mentioned in the first hour some of the problems I have with Opera, where I can literally have revolution.radio open on one tab and freedomslips.com open on the other tab. Freedomslips.com works perfectly well. Revolution.radio, the players don't work and the clocks are missing. So sometimes it can be a browser issue, but most of the time there's no problems at all. This wonderful website of ours has been established and lovingly maintained by the wonderful Monster383. So a big, big thank you to him. And you can explore the site. There's ways you can support us and you can find those ways on the site. The store there on the options, that's a link to our Zazzle store. Well worth exploring that one, folks. And also there's the you can support us electronically if you happen to live in the US or Canada and have a credit or debit card by clicking on donations and following the simple instructions that come up on the screen. You can't support us on a monthly basis using that option yet, but you can if you happen to be a patron of ours, because indeed we do have a Patreon page, which is well worth exploring, because we've got some very interesting, also well worth becoming a patron as well. You can only really explore the page if you're a patron. And we've got some very exciting plans in store for our patrons. So it's well worth becoming a patron. And you can do so on three different locations on the website. First one is at the top of the page between the migrating options and the Revolution Radio banner. Scroll just about under halfway down and you'll find the option nesting between the Hawk's Nest and the tribute there to Hawk. And then scroll down to more or less the bottom of the page and you will find it accompanying the snail mail options, which I'm just about to furnish you with. Check the money orders made payable to Revolution Radio. Yes, you can still send them to us. They are then to be posted to Terry Ackerman. That's a wonderful lady horse in the chat room. Terry spelled T-E-R-R-Y and Ackerman spelled A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. And the mailing address is 1793, that's 1793, North Eden spelled E-D-O-N Road. And that's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Michigan, M-I, 49227. So checks or money orders made payable to Revolution Radio are then to be mailed to Terry Ackerman at 1793, North Eden Road, that's Allen, Michigan, 49227. Alternatively, you've got a product or company you'd like to advertise on a cost-effective basis on a website that receives a healthy number of visitors per day. For $25 a month, you can advertise on the station's website. And if you'd like further details about how to go about that, you can contact either A Mad Painter or Lady Horse on the email addresses supplied on the website. And don't forget, folks, the archives are still free to access for the foreseeable, and you can reach the archives either by clicking on the archives option on the web page or going directly to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com. And the details you need to note and enter up, both are case sensitive, lowercase. The username is RevRadio, that's all one word, R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And the password is Rocks! R-O-C-K-S! And you must include that exclamation mark because that's an integral part of the password. But again, a big, big thank you to everyone for your continued support of the station. We are truly, truly grateful. Just thank you. Oh, what's apparently going on? Oh, 555 on B. Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm just looking at something in the chat room. So, folks, the doors are now open to the sultry snuggery that is Willow's Poetry Corner. And as you can see, the comfy cushions are scattered liberally across the deep pile hearth rug. The cooler late summer breeze whispers through the open window, and it's not so cool today, actually. It's not. It's been up in the 20s over here. And the scent of sandalwood subtly suffuses the senses, and the teas and coffees are freshly brewed. The dishes of dainty delectables are available, all sealed and packed, by the way. So settle yourselves down, folks, and we're going to devote the Poetry Corner for the next half hour to a study of one of the world of poetry's most colourful of characters. He's a man whose life and work continue to evoke inspiration and fascination 138 years after his death. He's one of the co-founders of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, and he was an artist extraordinaire as well. And his name is Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Now, if I have time, towards the end of the Poetry Corner, I will also read one of his poems. I mean, he is also the brother, of course, as well, of Christina Rossetti. And both are remarkably good poets. But we'll start with a biography of his, which I found on a wonderful site called victorianweb.org. And it was written by Glenn Everett, PhD, his biography. It tells you a fair bit about this rather remarkable man. Gabriel Charles Dante Rossetti, or Gabriel Charles Dante Rossetti, who later changed the order of his name to stress his kinship with the great Italian poet, was born in London on May the 12th, 1828, to Gabrielle and Francis Polidori Rossetti. Mr. Rossetti was an Italian patriot exiled from Naples for his political activity and a Dante scholar who became professor of Italian at King's College London in 1831. Since Mrs. Rossetti was also half Italian, the children, Maria, born in 1827 and died in 1876, Dante, William Michael, born 1828 and died 1919, and Christina, born 1830 to 94, grew up fluent in both English and Italian. As part of a large Italian expatriate community in London, they welcomed other exiles from Mazzini to organ grinders. And although they were certainly not wealthy, Professor Rossetti was able to support the family comfortably until his eyesight and general health deteriorated in the 40s. Certainly none of the family seems to have been obsessed with money the way that Tennyson was, for instance. Dante attended King's College School from 1837 to 1842, when he left to prepare for the Royal Academy at F.S. Carey's Academy of Art. In 1846, he was accepted into the Royal Academy, but was there only a year before he became dissatisfied and left to study under Ford Madox Brown. In 1848, he, William Holman Hunt, and John Everett Millais began to call themselves the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. The group attracted other young painters, poets and critics. William Michael Rossetti acted as secretary and later historian for the group. In 1849 and 50, DGR exhibited its first important paintings, The Girlhood of Mary Virgin and Ecce Ancilla Domini. At about the same time, he met Elizabeth Eleanor Sadow, a milliner's assistant, who became a model for many of his paintings and sketches. They were engaged in 1851, but did not marry until 1860, perhaps because of her ill health, his financial difficulties, or a simple unwillingness to undertake the commitment. A commission to cover the walls of the Oxford Debating Union with Arthurian murals introduced Rossetti to William Morris, Edward Burne-Jones, and A.C. Swinburne in 1856 and 57. While there, he also met Index Burden, with whom he fell in love, and introduced her to Morris, whom she married in 1859. After an engagement lasting nearly 10 years, Rossetti and Lizzie Tadell were married barely 20 months before she died from a self-administered overdose of morphia on February 10, 1862. Although suicide was suspected, the coroner generously decided that her death was accidental. After her death, Rossetti moved to 16 Cheyne Walk, Chelsea, a large house on the Thames which he shared with Swinburne and also, occasionally, his brother William Michael Rossetti and George Meredith. He continued painting and writing poetry, gaining patrons enough to become relatively prosperous. Another of his models, Fanny Cornforth, who appears in Bocca Baciata, The Blue Bower and Found, became his mistress and housekeeper, but because of her full-bodied blondness, never one of his idealised women. That role was filled first by Lizzie Tadell, occasionally by models like Ruth Herbert and Annie Miller, but most famously by Janie Morris. Rossetti's choice of models and his idealisation of them helped change the concept of feminine beauty in the Victorian period to the tall, thin, long-necked, long-haired stunners of frail health that we see in paintings like Beata Beatrix, Pandora, Corsapine, Appia, and La Donna della Finestra. The persistence of the pre-Raphaelite ideal shows up in photographs of William Butler Yeats's idealised beauty, Maud Gonne. Jack Yeats, the father of the poet, was connected with the pre-Raphaelite, and Yeats himself said of his younger days, "I was in all things pre-Raphaelite." In 1871, Rossetti and Morris leased Kelmscott Manor in Oxfordshire, and Morris visited Iceland, leaving Rossetti together with Jane and her children. Although biographers still argue about what exactly went on among them, the triangle was in any case a difficult situation for all concerned. In the late 60s, Rossetti began to suffer from headaches and weakened eyesight, and began to take chloral mixed with whiskey to cure insomnia. Chloral accentuated the depression and paranoia latent in Rossetti's nature, and Robert Buchanan's attack on Rossetti and Swinburne in the Fleshly School of Poetry from 1871, changed him completely. In the summer of 1872, he suffered a mental breakdown, complete with hallucinations and accusing voices. He was taken to Scotland, where he attempted suicide, but gradually recovered, and within a few months was able to paint again. His health continued to deteriorate slowly. He was still taking chloral, but did not much interfere with his work. He died of kidney failure on April 9th, 1882. I'll just share that one in the chat room, but I have got something else on here about him, which is from theartstory.org. And yeah, his movements and styles, yeah, he was pre-Raphaelites, Romanticism, aesthetic art and naturalism. And he worked, between... And I'm trying to work out the years, but it was about 30, 40 years. And here's a quote from Dante Gabriel Rossetti. "Beauty without the beloved is like a sword through the heart." So recognized by history as an inspired but provocative nonconformist, Dante Gabriel Rossetti made his name initially as a founding member of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. As mentioned, so the Brotherhood challenged the decadent indulgences of the day by looking for inspiration and religious guidance in medieval art. Rather than produce dramatic historical narratives, as was the fashion of the day, the Brotherhood adhered to an inflexible set of puritanical and aesthetic standards of which Rossetti soon tired. He continued to paint his mythical parables with the same luminosity and attention to the finest picture detail, but Rossetti, who harboured longings to be recognised also as a poet, became all-consumed with the idea of female beauty. His licentious lifestyle, though condemned by many of his colleagues, breathed erotic life, and it must be said, genuine personality into his art. But with time, his destructive lifestyle led to his mental decline, and as often happens after some time, this merely enhanced his legend as a prodigious maverick of the Victorian age. So his accomplishments here, as a leading light in the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood movement, Rossetti looked back to a period before the High Renaissance. He took inspiration in the purity and symbolism of medieval and religious fables found in 15th century Florentine and Sienese painting. Sorry, I'm pronouncing it the Italian way. Rossetti is recognized predominantly as a portraitist. His preference was for religious subject matter, but as he matured as an artist, his work proved most divisive because of his habit of using family members and lovers to represent holy icons. Rossetti was a founding member of the furnishing and decoration business, Morris Marshall Faulkner & Co. The company, established in 1861, was admired for their complex and vivacious designs. Though he soon lost interest in decorative arts, and though his relationship with William Morris suffered as a result, Rossetti's designs stand as a tangible link between the Pre-Raphaelites Brotherhood and Morris's arts and crafts movement. In his later life, Rossetti had wanted to abandon art and pursue his lifelong ambition of becoming a poet in the mould of his idols Dante, his namesake, Byron and Keats. However, his published collection was considered by critics to be too verbose, and this setback was thought to have contributed to a slowing in his artistic output, and was cited indeed as a catalyst for his drug addiction and mental deterioration. So here's the full biography on this one. And it's a lengthy one. A bit more detailed than the other one. So, Gabriel Charles Dante Rossetti was born in May 1828 to Italian emigres living in London. The boy's father, Gabriel Pasquale Giuseppe Rossetti, was a scholar. He was professor of Italian at King's College from 1831. A poet who had been exiled from Italy for his support for revolutionary nationalism. His English-Italian mother, Frances Mary Poldari, was the daughter of an exiled noble Italian scholar who, in addition to her maternal duties, enjoyed a career as a private teacher. The rich literary and cultural background of the couple saw that their passion for learning was passed down to all four of their children, Gabriel, Christina, William and Maria. The children were practicing Anglicans, but carried with them something of their father's Catholic worldview. From an early age, Gabriel Charles Dante chose to be addressed by his middle name, Dante, so as to emphasize his affinity with the medieval Italian poet and writer, about whom his father had written extensively. Indeed, Dante had been surrounded by art and literature of medieval Italy, and even as a boy had composed plays and poetry and produced drawings in this vein. Dante was able to develop his precocious talents for painting and writing through a combination of home education and schooling at King's College. He came to love Bible passages, Shakespearean tragedy, Edgar Allan Poe, and the poetry of Byron. As a teenager, he was torn between the ambition to become a poet or a painter, and often claimed that his true passion lay with writing and poetry. Education and early work. Rossetti studied at Henry Sass Drawing Academy between 1841 and 1845, and then for a further 3 years at the Antique School of the Royal Academy. By 1848, still aged just 20, Rossetti had a wealth of practical training behind him, yet he found himself at odds with the Victorian art establishment. To Rossetti, art of the academy seemed full of sentimental, fussy and moralistic scenes and staid, snobbish portraits. Rossetti was refreshed rather by the work of Ford Madox Brown, by his attention to detail, his graphic style and his daring use of colour. This style was far closer to the luminous medieval paintings that Rossetti adored. The young Rossetti asked Brown to tutor him, and he maintained a close relationship with the elder painter for the rest of his life. In the mid-1840s, Rossetti attended the exhibition of a painting called The Eve of St. Agnes by a young artist called William Holman Hunt. The painting was an illustration of a little-known Keats poem. Like Holman Hunt, Rossetti was a lover of Keats, and he saw in Hunt a kindred spirit who may share his artistic ideals and wish to confront the vapid face of the academy. Rossetti and Hunt began to share lodgings in Fitzrovia, and Rossetti became acquainted with a classmate of Holman Hunt at the Royal Academy of Arts, John Everett Millais. In 1848, the three artists met at Millais' parents' house on Gower Street and formed the first official meeting of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. By the autumn, the Brotherhood recruited four more members, painters James Collinson and Frederick George Stevens, poet and critic William Michael Rossetti, Dante's brother, and sculptor Thomas Woolner. The principles of the Brotherhood were manifold and in some ways complex. People like the influential critic John Ruskin had singled out Rossetti as the Brotherhood's de facto leader, and it was Rossetti who was determined to bring together a group of artists who were in actual fact buried and disparate. In his autobiography, however, Holman Hunt insisted that it was he and Millay who were the driving forces behind the birth of the Brotherhood, and that Rossetti was, at heart, a poet more than a painter. However, it was Rossetti who sought to lay out the Brotherhood's common goals. One, to have genuine ideas to express. Two, to study nature attentively so as to know how to express them. Three, to sympathise with what is direct and serious and heartfelt in previous art, to the exclusion of what is conventional and self-parodying and learned by rote. And four, most indispensable of all, to produce thoroughly good pictures and statues. The Brotherhood sought to return to a time before the dominance of Raphael and the mannerist artists who followed him. In other words, to emulate the spiritual, mythological and medieval, while attending to bold colourisation and fine picture detail. Complex and symbolic compositions, dual bright colours, detailed brushwork and poetic and historical references were all factors shared by the artists. The eminent critic John Ruskin wrote, "Every pre-Raphaelite landscape background is painted with the last touch, in the open air, in the thing itself. Every pre-Raphaelite figure, however studied in expression, is a true portrait of some living person." Most of all, the Brotherhood scorned the work of Royal Academy founder Sir Joshua Reynolds, who they collectively despised. As a way of publishing its writings and poetry, the Brotherhood created its own magazine called Germ. Not only were the seven members of the Brotherhood involved in the publication, but it also became associated with figures such as Christina Rossetti, Dante's sister, Maddox Brown, and the critical champion of the movement, John Ruskin. The first edition was published in 1850, and the public face of the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood was born. It proclaimed, "With a view to obtain the thoughts of artists upon nature as evolved in art, this periodical has been established, is not open to the conflicting opinions of all who handle the brush and palette, nor is it restricted to actual practitioners, but is intended to enunciate the principles of those who, in the true spirit of art, enforce a rigid adherence to the simplicity of nature, either in art or poetry." Rossetti, however, courted controversy from the outset.
Revolution, revolution, radio.
You don't see it, do you? How close we are to absolute chaos. The sick ones are sitting on their fat asses, eating and drinking themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do the nasty work. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. Not me. Get it done.
Revolution Radio, where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com.
Hello, Karl Marx here. Look at my wonderful hair. Notice how I sweep it back.
Karl?
I call it the 360 sweep. Beard, sideburns, and the magnificent coif.
Karl!
What? What is this?
You're on the radio. They can't see you.
Oh, yeah, I get confused.
Want to learn more about the Marxist agenda and other important stuff? Listen to The Ultimate Remedy with L.B. Bork, Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Seemingly with some awareness of the pair's clandestine relationship. Late period and death. After Lizzie's death, Rossetti's behaviour became more erratic. He moved into a Tudor house in Cheyne Walk, Chelsea, accompanied by Fanny, who resided nearby, and who became his housekeeper. Rossetti surrounded himself with extravagant furniture and exotic pets, including a wombat, cowboy hat-wearing toucan, and a llama. The astonishing house was captured by watercolourist Henry Treffery Dunn, who records such details as an original makeup of Chinese black-lacquered panels bearing designs of birds, animals, flowers, and fruit in gold relief. During the 1860s and early 1870s, Rossetti remained prolific in his portraits of beauties. Not only did he continue to paint Fanny and Jane Morris, he also discovered a new model, Alexa Wilding, a dressmaker and actress. He, in fact, painted more finished works of Wilding in this period than any other of his other models. This is due perhaps to the fact that they were not romantically entangled, although the two were close friends. By this late period in his life, Rossetti was desperate to realise his lifelong aspirations as a poet. However, his main body of poetry had been buried with Lizzie Siddal in Highgate Cemetery. In an erratic mood, Rossetti exhumed his wife's grave in 1870. He published his first volume of poems in the same year, under the title Poems by D.G. Rossetti. However, the work was poorly received and considered overworked and eroticised. An example of the fleshly school of poetry, as critic Robert Buchanan disparagingly described it. The disappointment of the poor reception of his poems, and the slowing in his painting output, contributed to a mental breakdown in the summer of 1872. Rossetti began to self-medicate with whiskey and chloral hydrate, until he became severely addicted. In 1874, his circumstances declined even further when William Morris cut Rossetti out of their shared decorative arts firm. For the remainder of his life, Rossetti became a recluse at Cheyne Walk, housebound due to alcohol, psychosis, liver damage and paralysis of the legs. He died on Easter Sunday of 1882 at the age of 53. Until the very end, Fanny Cornforth had visited and nursed Rossetti, even after she married another man in 1879. His most sensuous and passionate of models and lovers became a lifelong friend and confidant, and went on to pass many of Rossetti's paintings and memorabilia onto future generations. The legacy of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Rossetti was a driving force of a brotherhood and artists who came to follow him in the second wave of the brotherhood, from the 1850s onwards, artists rather. Most significantly, this included William Morris, Edward Burne Jones, and John William Waterhouse. This generation greatly admired Rossetti, particularly his decorative medieval style, and Rossetti was a great influence on the arts and crafts movement that Morris went on to form in the 1880s. Following his death, Rossetti was held up as a precursor to aestheticism and European symbolism. The cult of beauty and art for art's sake, alongside a decadent approach to life, were integral to artists and poets such as Aubrey Beardsley and Oscar Wilde. Yet after the turn of the century, Rossetti and the other pre-Raphaelites fell out of fashion. In the aftermath of the First World War, many modernists associated these artists with a suffocating Victorian culture and or a kind of decadent blindness to the ills of society and awfulness of the war to come. In the 1940s, Rossetti found the most unlikely of admirers in realist urban painter L.F. Lowry. While Lowry painted the grim realities of working life in Manchester, he also was an enthusiastic admirer and collector of Rossetti's work. He even set up the Rossetti Society in 1966. He was especially fascinated with Rossetti's visions of female beauty, stating that, "I don't like his women at all, but they fascinate me, like a snake." When Lowry died in 1970, he left many significant Rossetti paintings to the Salford Museum in Manchester. It is known, too, that the author J.R. Tolkien took inspiration from Pre-Raphaelite scenes for his vision of Middle-earth, as imagined in his Lord of the Rings universe. Today, Rossetti's work is reproduced en masse and is widely exhibited. His painting Proserpine sold for over $5 million in 2013, setting a new record for Rossetti's work. Critical perspectives on the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood now view the group as the first truly modern British artist. Art historian Jason Rosenfeld describes them in fact as the YBAs of their generation. Rossetti's personal life is also the subject of much retelling and fictionalisation, with continued fascination in the women behind the portraits. Contemporary Australian photographer Donna Stevens has recreated Rossetti scenes for the modern age, including her 2015 Love Letters to Rossetti portrait series. So there we go. Don't think I've got time to read any of his poetry, but I will certainly put it aside, actually, and read some for during the poetry corner. I won't be probably doing it this week, because I'll do all the poetry reading now on the Sunday show, but certainly going to bookmark what I've got. Interesting character, very drawn to him. I don't know why, she says with a wink. Anyway, let's wander over now, shall we, to Willow's Observatory. Couple of articles here, of course, deferred from last Thursday. And this first one is from NASA. Posted up on April 15th of this year. They're still very relevant. And it's Earth-sized habitable zone planet found hidden in early NASA Kepler data. So there's an editor's note to start this article, which is this release has been updated with the correct information on planet orbits and to add language about how this discovery relates to the field of astrology. A team of transatlantic scientists using reanalyzed data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope has discovered an Earth-sized exoplanet orbiting in its star's habitable zone, the area around a star where a rocky planet could support liquid water. Scientists discovered this planet, called Kepler 1649c, when looking through old observations from Kepler, which the agency retired in 2018. While previous searches of the computer algorithm misidentified it, researchers reviewing Kepler data took a second look at the signature and recognized it as a planet. Out of all of the exoplanets found by Kepler, this distant world, located 300 light years from Earth, is most similar to Earth in size and estimated temperature. This newly revealed world is only 1.06 times larger than our own planet. Also, the amount of starlight it receives from its host star is 75% of the amount of light Earth receives from our sun, meaning the exoplanet's temperature may be similar to our planet as well. But unlike Earth, it orbits a red dwarf. Though none have been observed in this system, this type of star is known for stellar flare-ups that may make a planet's environment challenging for any potential life. This intriguing distant world gives us even greater hope that a second Earth lies among the stars, waiting to be found, said Thomas Aberkin, Associate Administrator of NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington. The data gathered by missions like Kepler and our transiting exoplanet survey satellite, which is TESS, will continue to yield amazing discoveries as the science community refines its ability to look for promising planets year after year. There is still much that is unknown about Kepler 1649c, including its atmosphere, which could affect the planet's temperature. Current calculations of the planet's size have significant margins of error, as do all values in astronomy when studying objects so far away. Rocky planets orbiting red dwarfs are a particular astrobiological interest. However, astrobiologists will need much more information about this planet in order to gauge whether it is promising for life as we know it. But based on what is known, Kepler 1649c is especially intriguing for scientists looking for worlds with potentially habitable conditions. There are other exoplanets estimated to be closer to Earth in size, such as TRAPPIST-1f, and, by some calculations, T-Garden C. Others may be closer to Earth in temperature, such as TRAPPIST-1d and TOI-700d. But there is no other exoplanet that is considered to be closer to Earth in both of these values that also lies in the habitable zone of its system. Out of all of the mislabeled planets we've recovered, this one's particularly exciting, not just because it's in the habitable zone and Earth size, but because of how it might interact with this neighboring planet, said Andrew Vandenberg, a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, and first author on the paper released on that day in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. If we hadn't looked over the algorithm's work by hand, we would have missed it. Kepler-1649c orbits its small red dwarf star so closely that a year on Kepler-1649c is equivalent to only 19.5 Earth days. The system has another rocky planet of about the same size, but it orbits the star at about half the distance of Kepler-1649c, similar to how Venus orbits our Sun at about half the distance as Earth does. Red dwarf stars are among the most common in the galaxy, meaning planets like this one could be more common than we previously thought. So previously, scientists on the Kepler mission developed an algorithm called RoboVelta to help sort through the massive amounts of data produced by the Kepler spacecraft, managed by NASA's Ames Research Center in California's Silicon Valley. Kepler searched for planets using the transit method, staring at stars, looking at the dips in brightness as planets passed in front of their host stars. Most of the time, those dips come from phenomena other than planets, ranging from natural changes in a star's brightness to other cosmic objects passing by, making it look like a planet is there when it's not. RoboVelta's job was to distinguish the 12% of dips that were real planets. Those signatures RoboVelta determined to be from other sources were labeled false positives, the term for a test result mistakenly classified as positive. With an enormous number of tricky signals, astronomers knew the algorithm would make mistakes and would need to be double-checked. A perfect job for the Kepler false positive working group. That team reviews RoboVelta's work, going through all false positives to ensure they are truly errors and not exoplanets, ensuring fewer potential discoveries are overlooked. As it turns out, RoboVelta had mislabeled Kepler-1649c. Even as scientists work to further automate analysis processes to get the most science as possible out of any given data set, this discovery shows the value of double-checking automated work. Even 6 years after Kepler stopped collecting data from the original Kepler field, a patch of sky it stared at from 2009 to 2013, before going on to study many more regions, this rigorous analysis uncovered one of the most unique Earth analogues discovered yet. Kepler-1649c not only is one of the best matches to Earth in terms of size and energy received from its star, but it provides an entirely new look at its home system. For every four times the outer planet in the system orbits the host star, the inner planet orbits almost exactly nine times. The fact that their orbits match up in such a stable ratio indicates the system itself is extremely stable and likely to survive for a long time. Nearly perfect period ratios are often caused by a phenomenon called orbital resonance, but a 9-to-4 ratio is relatively unique among planetary systems. Usually resonances take the form of ratios such as 2-to-1 or 3-to-2. Though unconfirmed, the rarity of this ratio could hint the presence of a middle planet, with which both the inner and outer planets revolve in synchronicity, creating a pair of 3-to-2 resonances. The team looked for evidence of such a mystery third planet with no results. However, that could be because the planet is too small to see, or at an orbital tilt that makes it impossible to find using Kepler's transit method. Either way, this system provides yet another example of an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone of a red dwarf star. These small and dim stars require planets to orbit extremely close to be within that zone, not too warm and not too cold, for life as we know it to potentially exist. Though this single example is only one among many, there is increasing evidence that such planets are common around red dwarfs. The more data we get, the more signs we see pointing to the notion that potentially habitable and Earth-sized exoplanets are common around these kinds of stars, said Vandenberg. Red dwarfs almost everywhere around our galaxy, and these small, potentially habitable and rocky planets around them, the chance one of them isn't too different than our Earth looks a bit brighter. Missions such as Kepler and TESC help contribute to the field of astrobiology. The interdisciplinary research into understanding how the variables and environmental conditions of distant worlds could harbour life as we know it, or whatever other form that life could take. There we go. Share that one in the chat room. Next on the list is from the University of California, Irvine, or Irvine. Posted up on April 19th of 2020, so this year. And its Milky Way could be catapulting stars into its outer halo, UTI astronomers say. So we're back in our home galaxy here, folks. So it's saying the findings may change fundamental thinking about star system formation and dynamics. So though mighty, the Milky Way and galaxies of similar mass are not without stars chronicling turbulent histories. University of California Irvine astronomers and others have shown that clusters of supernovas can cause the birth of scattered, eccentrically orbiting suns in outer stellar halos, upending commonly held notions of how star systems have formed and evolved over billions of years. Hyper-realistic, cosmologically self-consistent computer simulations from the Feedback in Realistic Environments 2 project enabled the scientists to model the disruptions in otherwise orderly galactic rotations. This team's work is the subject of a study published on April that day in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. These highly accurate numerical simulations have shown us that it's likely the Milky Way has been launching stars in circumgalactic space and outflows triggered by supernova explosions, said senior author James Bullock, dean of UCI School of Physical Sciences and a professor of physics and astronomy. It's fascinating because when multiple big stars die, the resulting energy can expel gas from the galaxy, which in turn cools, causing new stars to be born. Bullock said that the diffuse distribution of stars in the stellar halo that extends far outside the classical disk of a galaxy is where the archaeological record of the system exists. Astronomers have long assumed that galaxies are assembled over lengthy periods of time as smaller star groupings come in and are dismembered by the larger body, a process that ejects some stars into distant orbits. But the UCI team is proposing supernova feedback as a different source for as many as 40% of these outer halo stars. Lead author Xiji Yu, a UCI PhD candidate in physics, said the findings were made possible partly by the availability of a powerful new set of tools. The Fire 2 simulation should allow us to generate movies that make it seem as though you're observing a real galaxy, she noted. They show us that as the galaxy center is rotating, a bubble driven by supernova feedback is developing with stars forming at its edge. It looks as though the stars are being kicked out from the center. Bullock said he did not expect to see such an arrangement because stars are such tight, incredibly dense balls that are generally not subject to being moved relative to the background of space. Instead, what we're witnessing is gas being pushed around, he said, and that gas subsequently cools and makes stars on its way out. The researchers said that while their conclusions have been drawn from simulations of galaxies forming, growing and evolving to the present day, there is actually a fair amount of observational evidence that stars are forming in outflows from galactic centres to their halos. Implotsa compared data from the European Space Agency's Gaia mission, which provides a 3D velocity chart of stars in the Milky Way, with other maps that show stellar density and metallic metallicity. We can see structures similar to those produced by outflow stars in our simulations, you say. Bullock added that mature, heavier metal-rich stars like our Sun rotate around the center of the galaxy at a predictable speed and trajectory. But the low metallicity stars, which have been subjected to fewer generations of fusion than our Sun, can be seen rotating in the opposite direction. He said that over the lifespan of a galaxy, the number of stars produced in a supernova bubble outflows is small, around 2%. But during the parts of galaxies' histories when starburst events are booming, as many as 20% of stars are being formed this way. There are some current projects looking at galaxies that are considered to be very starbursting right now, you said. Some of the stars in these observations also look suspiciously like they're getting ejected from the center. There you go, I'll share that one in the chat. And there's also some more technical details as well about how this was, this study came about in the article as well, which I recommend you read. Now, next on the list is from nature.com. I'm looking, should be able to fit this one in. This is from Nature.com, posted up the same day as the previous article, written by David Kafelbeki. And it's, this black hole collision just made gravitational waves even more interesting, reads the headline. So an unprecedented signal from unevenly sized objects gives astronomers rare insight into how black holes spin. Fascinating article, this. So gravitational wave astronomers have for the first time detected a collision between two black holes of substantially different masses, opening up a new vista on astrophysics and on the physics of gravity. The event offers the first unmistakable evidence from these faint space-time ripples that at least one black hole was spinning before merging, giving astronomers rare insight into a key property of these dark objects. It's an exceptional event, said Maya Fishbach, an astrophysicist at the University of Chicago in Illinois. Similar mergers on which data have been published all took place between black holes with roughly equal masses. So this new one dramatically upset that pattern, she said. The collision was detected last year and was unveiled on 18th of April by Fishbach and her collaborators at a virtual meeting of the American Physical Society, held entirely online because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, a pair of twin detectors based in Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana, and the Virgo Observatory near Pisa, Italy, both detected the event, identified as GW190412, with high confidence on 12th of April 2019. The LIGO-Virgo collaboration, which includes Fishbach, posted its findings on the ArcSys preprint server. LIGO made the first discovery of gravitational waves in September 2015, detecting the space-time ripples from two merging black holes. LIGO, later joined by Virgo, subsequently made 10 more detections in two observing runs that ended in 2017. 9 more black hole mergers and 1 collision of 2 neutron stars, which helped to explain the origin of the universe's heavy chemical elements. The third and most recent run started on 1st of April 2019 and ended on 27th of March 2020, with a month-long break in October. Greatly improved sensitivity enabled the network to accumulate around 50 more candidate events at a rate of roughly 1 per week. Until now, the international collaboration had unveiled only 1 other event from this observation period, the second merger between 2 neutron stars, dubbed GW190425, that was revealed in January. The latest event is unique. One of the 2 black holes that merged had an estimated mass of around 8 solar masses, and the other was more than 3 times larger at 31 solar masses. This imbalance made the larger black hole distort the space around it, so the other's trajectory deviated from a perfect spiral. This could be seen in the resulting gravitational waves, which were created as the objects spiraled into each other. All the other merger events that have been unveiled produced a wave that forms a similar chirp shape, which increases in both intensity and frequency up to the moment of collision. But GW190412 was different. Its intensity didn't simply rise as in a chirp. This makes this system very interesting, just looking at the morphology of the signal, Fishbach said. Physicists have eagerly awaited such non-vanilla events because they provide new, more precise ways of testing Albert Einstein's theory of gravity, the general theory of relativity. We're in a new regime of testing general relativity, said Maximiliano Isi, at the Massachusetts Institution of Technology in Cambridge, another LIGO member who was presenting at the meeting. In particular, researchers were able to use this data to discern the spin of black holes. We know with confidence that this heavier object had to be spinning, said Isi. Previous events had left researchers baffled. Observations of black holes in the Milky Way suggested that black holes should have high spins, but this did not show up in gravitational wave data from the first 2 runs. Astrophysicists hope that detecting spins can shed light on how the black holes formed and came to orbit each other. The richer information in asymmetrical mergers helps to measure an event's distance from the Milky Way with better precision. Accumulating many such measurements could provide a new way to map the history of the expansion of the universe. The LIGO-Virgo collaboration will continue to publish more results from its vast trove of unpublished data, including individual events that are particularly interesting or exciting, says Virgo's Joe van der Brand, a physicist at the National Institute for Subatomic Physics in Amsterdam. I think the harvest is quite good. Let me put it like that. I'm not going to have time to start the next article, folks. So I'll save that to the next observatory, which is probably not going to be Thursday. It'll probably be next week. But we're coming up to the top of the hour now, folks, and just telling you what's going to be happening on the station tonight. Coming on after me at on this very, we'll start the studio A. Coming on after me at 4 p.m. will be Mr. Rowe with Crypto Corner. Coming up at 5 p.m. will be Deacon John with Liberation Nation. Following Deacon at 6 p.m. will be Jimmy Jean with Into the Microcosm. And following Jimmy at 8 p.m. will be Lorian Fenton with the Fenton Perspective. Rounding off the evening here on Studio A will be the wonderful A.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us.